Good morning. Welcome to KDBS Davis 90.3 FM. This week in science, Kirsten and Ted talking to each other as normal.
Yeah.
Not mindful of the pots that tell us that
we're on the
microphones
air.
Are on. Yeah.
Ooh,
I don't need you cramping my style, man.
Yeah, and you've got plenty of style today, what with those cop sunglasses and all.
That's right. I'm too cool for school.
That's my line.
Yeah, but I'm the one who's too cool for school.
That may be true, but that's my line.
Shades. It is your line.
Uh-oh. I'll fight you later for that.
Give us the station stuff. What are you doing over there?
Doing our own thing, obviously. Sesame Street here. 752-2777 is the number to call at any point during the show if you'd like to join us here on the air. Websites, kdvs.org and TWIS, or thisweekinscience.com or twis.org. And on with the show.
On with the show.
This Week in Science.
So what do you got?
Oh, I was reading a story this morning. I didn't have a chance to print it out, but in Egypt they found bricks that are they're something like 4,000 years old that were used for birthing by women in Egypt, where these bricks, where the women would squat on them to have their child.
Birthing bricks,
yeah. It's on the New York Times website. They've got a story about the birthing bricks.
How
in
are
Egypt.
They? Do you know, or can you recall how they were able to determine that these bricks were specifically used for burning instead of making bread or something?
I wasn't
like
able to get that far, so I just wanted to bring it up, though, because I thought it was kind of an interesting thing to discover about a brick.
Yeah.
I think the brick was really the only form of Egyptian technology. Everything was in some form. There were birthing bricks, eating bricks, pooping bricks.
Big death bricks in pyramidal form.
Yeah, bricks used for killing people, bricks used for bringing people into the world, bricks used for building giant triangular-shaped objects, which seemed to be their thing.
I had great birthing success bricks. With it. Some of those structures still stand.
That's true. You know, it's hard to knock down a giant triangular brick. Were bricks just the softest? Did they sleep on bricks?
I guess they must have. I have no idea. In other old news...
Old
news, yeah. There's a map that is supposedly... was supposedly drawn up by Vikings when they were traveling the world. And it's this map has part of it, you know, how Christopher Columbus is supposedly the first person to have discovered America, the New World, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, in the past 500 years.
Right. But anyway, the Vikings got there first. And or at least that's what this map that showed up at Yale University in 1965 supposedly proves, because it's got this picture of this place called Vinland.
Yeah.
That was across the Atlantic Ocean and had lots of vines growing on it. But anyway, so Leif Erikson supposedly discovered this area called Vinland, and they drew it on their map. And so there's this map that showed up in 1965, and nobody's been able to, you know, there's been controversy, immediate controversy as to whether or not it's the real thing, and okay, did the Vikings really discover it, or is this a fake, or what's going on? And so two papers came out this past week, one of them proving definitively that, yes, indeed, this map is from, you know, was made in the year of, like, 1434, or whatever, and the other one proves definitively that it couldn't have been manufactured before 1920. And so it's really interesting how the definitive proof for this map being real is based on radiocarbon dating, where they actually radiocarbon dated the parchment that the map was drawn on. And this other group that says it's a forgery, they were actually using... they're a chemistry group who used spectroscopy to determine the chemical makeup of the ink that was used to draw on the map. And so the radiocarbon dating, which uses a radioactive form of carbon of carbon to determine and how long it takes carbon, its half-life, to break down, Yeah, that one says, okay, it's a really old map. The parchment itself is really old. And this other one, they discovered a material that's a form of titanium dioxide that's not known to have been manufactured before the 1920s in the map's ink. And so the question is it real? Is it a fake? No one knows still.
My solution is the parchment is really that old and the ink is relatively new.
So yeah, no brainer.
Right.
Somebody drew a map on old parchment and this is what you get.
Yeah, that's one of the ideas. The other idea is that, you know, there's a couple of other ideas that maybe, you know, something in the ink, like the chemicals in the ink, interacted to create this kind of form of titanium dioxide over time in the ink.
That's
probably not. And then the final idea is that maybe the Norsemen in the 9th century who were drawing the map actually knew a lot more about ink than we think they did. You know, that maybe they had this compound that we didn't have until the 1920s.
Yes, the famed ink-making Vikings of yore.
Who knows, man? They made big boats, too.
Known across Scandinavia for their fearless writing style.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so anyway, that's the big archaeology news this week. I don't know if it's archaeology or...
That's archaeology.
It's archaeology. It's archaeology. Chemistry. It's radiocarbon dating. It's kind of neat.
Archaeology would be nowhere without modern dating methods.
Exactly.
By the way,
Christopher Columbus didn't discover the New World in 1492.
Oh, no, neither did
the
Vikings.
Just to make a point. Right. In 1492? No, they didn't.
The Chinese actually probably got here before the Vikings, the coast of San Francisco.
Probably.
And walked all the way down, and about 11,000 years ago, people walked across a land bridge from East Asia and slaughtered off all the mini mammoths and various other saber-toothed tigers, smilodons.
You're blaming the death of all of those prehistoric creatures on Chinese travelers?
No. No, I'm blaming them on earlier humans.
Earlier
travelers.
Humans, okay.
Probably from the same region as modern China, Mongolia.
The Mongolian...
But much earlier, not... No, they're
more
actually...
More prehistoric.
Like Chinese, year 500 to 800 Anno Domini, giant, 100-ship expedition to America. They're pretty much sure, landed off the coast of San Francisco, and they kind of trekked down the coast.
And you thought how many ships had a problem? I guess one or two might land.
Oh, they think actually quite a few made it. You know, they were designed to be scuttled once they got here. And it was kind of like one of these Mission to Mars, you're not coming back missions.
Right.
It was just just a bunch of people. And Vikings, they definitely made it. But as for the sea charts, I doubt they would.
Yeah, they probably hit the northeast, probably the Newfoundland area.
Yeah, that's what they think, that area of Canada. And because we know when they did their whole expansion, it was because they got lucky. They were in this brief global fever where the earth warmed up by maybe, up to a degree and a half Celsius, and the whole northern Atlantic got a lot easier to travel.
Yeah.
And they were also...
That's ice.
They're on the run, Eric the Red and Leif Erikson, who was Eric the Red's son. They were being pursued by pretty much all of the seafaring tribes of England and Ireland and Saxony because they were really mad at them, and so they went to America.
Got a call. Hey, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, I just have one more story of ancient science reborn. Have you guys heard about the Egyptian beer they're now making?
Yeah.
Oh, is that old news?
I haven't
heard about it.
Well, the researchers in California have just decided to try to manufacture a 4,000-year-old recipe for beer that they found in Egyptian tombs. It's going to have 10% alcohol, and they say it's only going to be for research purposes. But
yeah,
who knows?
Those
it might
lab
make those
parties.
Birding bricks softer.
I'm going to get saucy and walk like an Egyptian. Sweet.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Yes, look for, you know, King Tut brew on your shelves soon.
What are they making it out of?
Hopefully not 4,000-year-old.
They haven't revealed the secret recipe just yet.
I wonder if honey is a component of it, or what the heck they would
probably
make that out of. If it's going to be like meatish, or if it's going to be like true beer. It's going to be like a pale, like a Hefeweizen?
I think it's true beer.
Well, 10% alcohol, that's pretty hefty.
That is, it's pretty gnarly.
It's a triple buck.
That's a bit better than Budweiser, that's all I can say.
Thanks
for the update.
Thanks for calling.
If I can find that Egyptian beer out, I'll give it a taste.
Not to be confused with Pyramid Brewery.
No.
I think that's, I think that's something that they should... And once they actually figure out whether or not the recipe's any good, they should put it on the internet that, you know, we can all...
Thousands of Egyptians
try and
can
partake of Egyptian beer.
Get you housed like an old school priest of Ra. I was reading about that somewhere, and yeah, they're going to try and do... I think it's a wheat and like corn or something, but it couldn't be corn. But it was like wheat. And, because, like, the first real beer was, like, developed in, like, hate to say it, but, like, Iraq, I think.
Yeah.
I could be totally wrong. But, I remember they used to give it to the pharaohs until they found, like, opium. Because most of the pharaohs, by about the age of 18 or 19, if they lived that long, got to live in just pretty much horrible tooth pain all the time. Because we didn't figure this out until recently with
bad
more...
Bad dentistry?
Well,
It
was actually bad... that combined with the fact that the pharaohs got to eat this really special kind of bread that was ground up by these special pistles that were made out of this kind of... It was kind of one of these, like, you know, it was, you know, a privilege that you got to eat this ghost. It was really nice. But only recently we found out...
But it made your teeth rot.
Yeah, it was filled with, basically little grains of sand. And over... their childhood and early adult years, it would slowly eat holes in their teeth, so they'd have cavities formed by just, you know, sedimentation and, like...
Abrasion.
Yeah, so they've looked at Tut and stuff, and they've looked at some of the mummies we found.
He had no teeth.
Yeah, well, they had just, like, horrible abscesses, and, like, the roots were exposed, and so what we've found, kind of deduced is, that they would dope up the pharaohs. You know, like, it... in a pain alleviating measure. You know, like the pharaohs were always in horrible pain, so they'd just get them drunk. And then they found like opium, and they found like, you know, these guys were on opium all the time because they were just in horrible pain. And
that is so funny.
Yeah, it might explain a lot of things like, oh, build me a giant tomb shaped like a pyramid, and then be sure to lock yourselves in it when you're done. You know, and they did it because he was the son of God.
You're the pharaoh. All
right. Yeah, totally. We'll do what you tell us. God incarnate. Okay, I'll just do that. Don't want to go to hell.
I think the Son of God or the living incarnation of their one of their gods, you know, has the right to be housed all the time. So
dang right.
It's part of the perks of the
job,
right?
If you're living in ancient Egypt with, you know, aliens visiting every couple hundred years demanding tribute,
you
would drive a man to drink. Yeah, you got Kurt Russell showing up trying to put nuclear bombs in your pyramids and... British folks stealing your treasures.
Yeah.
I say.
And you're flying around in your little rocket pharaoh car.
Yeah,
I say.
Pointing your ankh at people with ray guns coming out of it. Egyptians.
Stargate. So good. Anyhow, what else?
What else? Oh. In cannabis research, our brain has naturally existing cannabinoid receptors, which when we smoke marijuana, or if one smokes marijuana, which contains THC, the THC goes and binds to all these receptors and stimulates all of them to get working. But, yeah.
The receptors will start working anyway.
Right. And so researchers have been looking, and once they found these cannabinoid receptors, they've been looking into what these cannabinoid receptors actually do. And a lot of them are involved in pain pathways, other sensory pathways, emotion, and movement. And a lot of receptors are found in the amygdala, which is an area of our brain that's basically involved in our fear response to things. And so what these researchers did is they designed some mice to lack a particular, so that they didn't have a particular cannabinoid receptor, the CB1 receptor. And then they had a group of mice that they just left alone and were normal mice. And then they trained the mice to respond to a tone and a shock, so that whenever they heard a tone, they would get an electrical shock. And so the mice learned to be afraid of the tone. And a week later, they were repeatedly exposed to the tones, but there was no shock given. And so over time, normal mice just quickly learn in about a week, okay, the tone's all right again. I don't have to be afraid anymore. But the mice that were modified,
lacking that cannabis
receptor, lacking the receptor, it took about 6 times longer than the normal mice for them to extinguish their fear response. And so, and then when the researchers also blocked the CB1 receptors in the normal mice by using a blocker for the receptor so that they couldn't be stimulated, the normal mice were then unable to stamp out negative associations.
So the reason this is cool is because when a person smokes a lot of marijuana or ingests a lot of marijuana and their THC receptor becomes full, or that cannabis receptor becomes full,
we have
THC,
them, yeah.
Then we don't learn to not. Is that where the paranoia comes from?
Oh, that's a good question. I hadn't thought that far out.
Because what this research is saying is that you're...
That these cannabinoid receptors are involved in getting rid of negative emotions. And mm-hmm. so, like, if you had a really bad experience and didn't have any cannabinoid receptors in your amygdala, then you probably wouldn't be able to, like,
this doesn't actually have to do with intaking cannabis. This has to do with your cannabinoid receptors.
It could be in terms of phobia or post-traumatic stress disorder type things, where people are, like, really paranoid or have a lot of, or PTSD is what they call it,
post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, and so, like, marijuana or the THC, if able to be given in a direct dose, uh-huh. it could help alleviate those symptoms.
Okay.
So I don't know for certain what, like, the paranoia aspect of... That probably comes from the fact that, like, all of, you know, it's not like a real direct stimulus. Marijuana goes in and it just, like, goes blah, you know, here, so. All over your brain, you know, and all of the different areas of your brain are...
Well, I bet the paranoia thing also comes from the social aspect. It's like, yeah, because your brain's going haywire, and it's just because that whole, you're thinking about everything. And it's like, because, you know, it's like, ooh, you could get in trouble and it's illegal, and what if the neighbors notice or something?
Yeah, but I think there's that aspect of it.
Because you can't judge it properly.
Yeah, there's that aspect of it, but because of these, like, different, all these pathways are being stimulated in your brain, you're not able to respond in the way that you normally
would.
Well, yeah,
that's what I mean. So you can't mm-hmm. judge the associate, you know, mm-hmm. assign how worried you should get. You know, and that disappears, like, the fifth time you smoke pot, and if you're a total stoner, you don't worry about it anymore. But that wasn't actually
maybe
of this experiment.
Maybe
they didn't actually give weed to the mice.
They didn't give weed to the mice.
Whether the receptors were there or not.
No. They did go in and they looked at the animals' brains later on, though, in their amygdala, and they found that those that were unlearning the bad association with the tone had higher levels of two naturally existing cannabinoids in their brain than those who hadn't been trained.
Okay. Cannabinoids or cannabinoid receptors?
No, cannabinoids. So there are naturally produced cannabinoids.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there's the issue of, okay, do you have, number one, do you have the receptors in your brain? And number two, are you producing the cannabinoids that are necessary to stimulate them? So
brain biochemistry is so wacky.
Yeah,
I know. It's so cool.
Yeah, it really is. It's such
I think that's a good, that your point that you brought up, though, about the paranoia and stuff, I think that would be an interesting aspect for them to look into from now, though. Like, from this kind of a result to, like, look into, okay, where does it, you know, okay, so we know that this has something to do with negative emotions and our ability to deal with them or not deal with them.
Yeah. I mean, it could lead, potentially lead to some kind of treatment or aid for paranoid schizophrenics or people with other mental disabilities. So
smoke more doobie.
Well, schizophrenics do that naturally. It's like a like self-medication, basically. It's like smoking cigarettes or smoking marijuana. It's actually a self-medicating.
Let them do it.
I know, I know. Don't tell them it's bad. That's
my God, let them do it.
Jesus. Yeah, government, listen to us. We know what's
up. We do. We know you're monitoring us anyway. Listen, can I segue with some segueable stories?
Oh, please do.
Get something on the whole nature of paranoia.
Segueable.
And brain chemistry. I love this. University of Zurich in Switzerland. Great study linking people's tendency to believe in the supernatural and skeptics with, dopamine amounts in the brain. This is beautiful.
I think that this one, like, this story especially applies to one of our callers who called in a couple of weeks ago with some supernatural-type questions.
Could be. We don't want to generalize, but let's generalize here. Yeah. Yeah, essentially what they're finding is that higher levels of dopamine in one's brain makes them more likely to believe in the paranormal. That's quite a big stretch of reasoning, but essentially what they're saying is that the thought behind this work is that more dopamine somehow makes people more likely to see connections where there are none, and, you know, see related events and patterns where there are none, and skeptics, you know, tend to have lower. So the way they tested this was by taking...
Skeptics are a bit more depressed, I think.
Yeah, skeptics live in the real world. It sucks, so they're forced to have to smoke a lot of doobie.
That's an interesting bit of reasoning right there.
Well...
I'm not saying I disagree. I'm just.
I mean, how many
where
skeptics?
Else do skeptics?
How many
live?
Skeptics? I mean, okay, yeah, I'm a skeptic a lot of the time, but still. I mean, there's like this. I mean, you have the people who run around with a smile on their face saying, "I believe in fairies," you know, and.
Yeah. Well, there's different
happy
types of
people,
skeptics.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, it's a broad spectrum to say there's those who believe in the paranormal and those who don't. You know, there's all this.
Yeah.
There's optimistic skeptics, there's pessimistic skeptics, you know, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. You know what I mean? It's like, I know people who believe in fairies and dragons, and they're bummed all the time. And I also know skeptics who believe that everything's going to be great, you know, and I also know skeptics who are,
fine.
But anyway, what they're saying is...
tear down my theory.
I'm agreeing with you.
Okay.
Yeah, I say, like, you know, you're a skeptic, but you're a loon. You're not one of these skeptics who thinks life isn't worth living, you know. You're like a cool skeptic.
Thanks.
I try to be a cool skeptic. But,
it's all because
it's
my antidepressant regime.
There you go. Me too. Well, it's like, you know, I mean, tell me if we're all skeptics here, but still, there's certain things you just like, the buttered side of the bread will always land on the floor. Am I right?
Absolutely.
It does, you know, or like when you're about to drop your pants and take a dump, you know, someone calls. It happens. These are facts of the universe. That will one day be scientifically borne out. But for now...
Or somebody comes and knocks on the door.
Yeah, or someone comes and knocks on the door. And it's always someone you don't... It's the Jehovah's Witnesses. You know. You want to come in and help me take a crap? I'd love to hear you. Do I have a copy of your book or whatever the hell it is?
Yeah, I need some reading material.
Anyway. Okay, sorry.
Okay, so skeptics?
Angry at world revenge soon. Take out on everybody. Yes, the dopamine skeptic story. We haven't already burnt this out?
Yeah,
already.
More supernatural.
Yeah, so they sat all these fools down, made them look at a bunch of very quickly flashing pictures of people's faces and then, like, sketches of faces that weren't really real, but, like, you know, too fast for you to consciously register. And they had, you know, people, like, write down how many real things versus fake they thought they saw. And sure enough, they had two groups of people who were, because, you know, and this is one of these things where it does get a little subjective because there is no scientific test to tell someone who's a skeptic or not. It has to be, you know, like, are you a skeptic or not? So they have, like, two groups of people, those who were self-confessed skeptics and those who were self-confessed believers in supernatural. And sure enough, the skeptics... they saw, like, when it was a real face, they saw the real face, and when it was fake, they saw a fake face. And those groups claiming to believe in the paranormal more often, much more often than skeptics, would find a real face where it was just like a drawing of a face. So they're you know, more likely to draw and fill in the blanks and see connections where there aren't any. And then they shot them all up with dopamine, both the skeptics and the other ones. That has totally hopped them up on dopamine. And,
I love it.
Yeah, and then the...
make
the
connections!
Skeptics became more likely to make connections and stuff between things that weren't there once they were all hopped up on dopamine. However, interestingly enough, those that had already been doing it, the added dopamine made no difference, suggesting that there's like some kind of plateau.
Plateau, right.
So a little...
I wonder, like, not just skeptics, but I mean, I wonder how this would help people with absolutely no common sense.
What, taking out some of their dopamine levels?
Give them some dopamine, so maybe they'll actually make more connections than they are making.
Well, there are so. Have you heard, there's like this syndrome that people, like, they don't have an imagination? And it's like weird. I've heard interviews, they're intelligent, they can speak, you know, they can learn their language, but they're like Vulcans. And they have to, no, seriously, they have, and they have real, they can't read. It's like they know how to read, but they can't, they have real trouble comprehending something after they read it because they can't, especially like fiction, they just like, they'll describe reading fiction and they just don't understand what it is they're supposed to do with the thing. Because like,
they have
they
no imagination.
Make believe.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, they
can't
have absolutely
picture
no imagination.
It.
They have to go to like the school, and after a while, they can actually they have to like teach themselves to imagine. It's not natural. And the
that
brain.
That would be absolutely horrifying. That's one of the the main things I rely on is my power of imagination. Look,
yeah,
get me
bizarre.
Through the day.
Yes.
In some kind of successful manner.
I don't like my life. Let's imagine something better.
Let's imagine me playing some cards. We got to take a quick station break
public
here.
Right. Service time.
Yes, yes. But we will be back. Stay tuned. You're listening to KDVS Davis 90.3 FM, This Week in Science. Welcome back to KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. This is This Week in Science. The phone number here is 530-752-2777. And we encourage all of our listeners to go ahead and call in with any kind of questions or comments they might have. A couple websites, www.kdvs.org and www.thisweekinscience.com.
Excellent.
Excellent.
More show, more science.
Master science.
How very true. So what else is going on in the world of...
I have something about the brain, again.
I like the brain.
Australians. This could probably be a contender for this week's Australia bashing story.
Really?
Although, you know, I don't want to be quick to bash them. Yeah, I do. Well, this is kind of a cool idea here. These guys at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, that's in Australia. For those of you unfamiliar with Australian geography, that's in Australia. It's on the northeast coast. And what they have done is they built a virtual reality environment for people with schizophrenia. This virtual reality environment is designed to simulate their hallucinations.
I read about this.
They have, it's a 3D sim, typically projects, like, they'll tailor it to the to the individual sufferer, but typically it's like projects like, you know, a living room or house setting, and then the edges of the vision are kind of blurry, and there's a constant abusive running soundtrack similar to schizophrenic hallucinations. They will also see various shapes distort and like see photographs maybe morph from one person to another, and essentially, it's a VR environment designed to, mimic their hallucinatory experience. The idea being that this will help people come to terms with their illness and realize that, you know, it better have a better way to deal with their hallucinations. There are a few people saying this kind of sounds a little bit frightening, but hey, they're saying that their experience is showing that it works pretty well.
Really? So they've actually put schizophrenics in the machine?
I guess, they've had some people volunteer, and
it's gone okay for them?
Well, is it just kind of training to, this isn't real?
Well, it's early
days. You know
days.
This isn't real, and when you see something like this, just know it's not real.
Yeah, it's like feedback. It's like, Yeah, it's like, okay, you go to the doctor's office and they're going to put this helmet on you or whatever, and they're going to say, okay, see this? Looks a lot like your hallucinations. So if we can make something that looks like your hallucinations and you know that it's fake, well, then maybe you know that your hallucinations are all in your head, I guess, is the reasoning behind it.
But what if they come up with some kind of big conspiracy theory that they've implanted something in their...
Well, yeah, exactly. It could mess with people's heads. But, I mean, you know, that's the same, you know, that already, that happens to schizophrenics when they go to the doctor anyway and they get a pill.
Yeah.
You know, it's full of Freemasons or something.
I just ate a pill full of Freemasons.
Microscopic Freemasons.
Wait a minute.
I mean, to generalize all schizophrenics because, you know, that would be wrong. It's just wacky. It's like...
It does sound completely wacky.
You know, some video game developers are going to buy this guy's idea and like, hey man, that's like a cool idea, and like, you know, turn in the next Resident Evil or something.
Which would also be pretty sweet.
Some of the psychosis depicted is not as florid and as lucid as some people see, but it helps you realize what a person with mental illness is going through, says Dr. Peter Darling. So, yeah, there you go.
I'd be kind of curious to strap myself in for like 5 minutes.
Oh, I'd love to see
what
it.
It's like maybe to be a schizophrenic or...
Yeah, but it's
a thing. I'm sure it's nothing near what it's actually really like to be schizophrenic. But if you're already schizophrenic and then you have like an idea of like... Yeah, you can go in to tell a doctor. It's like, well, yeah, you know, it's not really like that with me. It's more like a feeling or a whatever, or I'm just kind of driven to do this all the time. So, but I guess for those who actually have auditory or visual hallucinations, it can
really maybe be helpful.
Yeah, they have a woman who went through it who says it, you know, did some pretty remarkable work ameliorating her symptoms. So, yeah, there you go. You know, technology. We have a call here.
Hey, caller, you're on the air.
I was doing some research about like schizophrenics art, you know, like what they draw and stuff like that, their artwork. And a lot of them had one common theme running out through their artwork, and that was eyeballs coming out of their hands and eyeballs coming out of everything.
Really?
But the key thing was like eyes out of the hands, like kind of like the Independent skateboard logo from the 80s.
Oh, hell yeah.
That was totally like, you know... Like, that was considered to be a pretty much, you know, schizophrenic artwork.
Really?
And, yeah, that was, like, the one current theme that ran through children's art and, like, adults' art, and it was just kind of a really prevalent thing. They saw eyes everywhere.
I wonder if that's, like, schizophrenics from all over the world and all cultures?
That was, yeah. It was that's what I just said. They did research with kids, and they did research all over the earth, and that's one of the common threads, especially with people... That didn't, you know, hadn't seen other people's work and stuff like that.
Huh. That's fascinating.
It's kind of like a mass delusion kind of a thing.
I'll have to look into that. I've never heard that one before.
I wonder why that would be so prevalent.
Because they think that people are looking at them. They think there's cameras everywhere and stuff like that, especially paranoid schizophrenics.
Right.
Huh. Which being slightly different than your average schizophrenic.
Right. Slightly.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Thank you for calling.
Thanks very much. Have a great day.
Cheers.
Hey, you too. Thanks for sharing that with us.
It's really interesting.
That is kind of cool. It's kind of creepy too.
I wonder if anybody's done like more research into that. Actually,
probably.
Well, you never know. Like sometimes people just notice things and.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't until like 2 years ago that they started studying why. You know, like schizophrenic smokes so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it used to be like you can't say that. That's just anecdotal. And it's like no. Schizophrenic people, diagnosed schizophrenics, do smoke more than the average population.
Yeah.
And more than, so why is this? And they like to say, yeah, there's a lot of little things that people just, for whatever reason, don't...
Well, for
just
that.
Kind of accept it and don't...
Yeah. And that was like, yeah, dopamine.
It's not worth studying. It's not
yeah,
worth
totally.
It.
For the schizophrenic smoking, I think it's probably more of like a
it's
comfort
compulsive.
Control
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, it's habit, it's control, but there's also, you know, huge amounts of dopamine. You know, it tones down the brain, sharpens the concentration.
Yeah, in other, like, not researched until recently news, the ability to count is something that's pretty much a primate ability, or a higher, more highly evolved, I guess, would be the anthropocentric term to use.
And ducks can't count.
Birds and rodents and things like that, they can tell, you know, if one pile of food or something is bigger than another. They can tell, like, generally the size, the amount is larger. But the ability to count has to an animal has to recognize that each object corresponds to a single number, and that the last number in the sequence represents like the total number of objects, or that if you take one away, then the total number is reduced. And people haven't studied dogs at all, and so this guy in Brazil suspected that dogs can count or have this ability to recognize numbers. And so what they did is they subjected the dogs to a test that's similar to the test that they use with babies to determine whether or not they can count, where they put have like a screen that comes down, and then the screen comes up and there's one object, and the screen goes down, and the, you know, the person will, or there's like a, I think that's like there's a screen in the way, and a mm-hmm. person will show the baby one object and put it behind the screen, and then show the baby another object and put it behind the screen, and it then raised the screen up. And if the number behind the screen corresponds to the number of objects that have been put behind the screen that the baby has seen, the baby's just like, eh, whatever, you know, and it's not anything big deal. But if it doesn't match, then the baby, like, sits and stares at it. Like,
yeah.
You know, there's something not, there's, you're messing with me here. You know, and so they did this test with dogs, and dogs acted the same exact way as babies. And so, you know, when, you know, 1 plus 1 equaled 2, the dogs were just like, eh, whatever. And then when 1 plus 1 equaled 3, the dogs spent a lot more time inspecting the objects and going, that's not quite right.
It's not what they expected.
Yeah.
Although skeptics are saying it may be a dog's keener sense of smell that lets them know that one pile is bigger than the other.
Okay, then we'll just have to do the test without dog bones. You know, do the test with, I mean, yeah, seriously, do the test with balls or with, you know, something that, look, it's a ball. You want to play? We'll put it here. You know, I'm sure. I have, you know, anecdotal evidence of, like, friends of mine with really, really intelligent dogs.
Any dog owner or dog lover will tell you, you know, yeah, this is stuff we've known for hundreds of years.
Right. And one friend in particular, he had, forget what, Australian
shepherd?
Sheepdog?
Australian
shepherd.
Sheepdog's about the smartest breed of dog in the world.
Yeah, Australian sheepdog. And what he would do is, like, over time, he had this basket of toys, and he would, he trained the dog to fetch, you know, which isn't a hard thing to train a dog to do, but he trained...
Try telling that to my dog.
He trained the dog to fetch, and then he started, like, really playing with the dog and saying, you want this ball? This ball? The red ball? Or, you know, whatever shape he'd like, do you want the square? And he had like all these different shape objects and like color objects, and over time he would like train, he just kept using these words with the objects over and over and over again, until eventually the dog would be like, I want to play, and there'd be all this stuff out in the lawn, and he'd say, go get the red ball, or go get, you know, the green square or something. And the dog would seriously go and get the right object and bring it back to him. And so,
when you're saying red ball, blue ball, the dog thinks red means smell because they say
black.
Right,
you know, it doesn't matter what, it doesn't matter if they understand, like,
the
same meaning.
The end result
is
the same.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, dogs are basically colorblind. So, yeah. I mean, red isn't something.
And walleye vision.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're going to be basically probably seeing, like, some shade of, like, gray or, like, a purplish blue or something.
But each one,
you know,
each ball probably has a very distinct smell to them.
Right. Everything is going to be distinct in the dog's way of seeing it, so.
What about the dogs being able to count? I heard that perhaps an explanation for that is they developed as pack animals. And living in a pack, it's important to keep track of the other members of your pack, and
potential enemies or allies, or absolutely. I mean, I think that's part of why people have studied primates. You know, other than the fact that they're human, knowing that humans possibly came from primates, is that, you know, they have these social groups, and animals with social groups. Absolutely, when they work together and develop together, they absolutely have, you know, distinct behaviors that develop. And so, I mean, and when you're talking about a flock of birds, you know, that's not necessarily, you know, that doesn't run the same way as, you know, a social group of bonobos or a social group of wolves. where everyone works together in the hunt.
There's actually planning involved, like with canines and primates, there's like forethought.
There's forethought,
basic arithmetical ability. I mean, birds, it's like simple rules, essentially. Like, three rules govern a bird's life.
If you're right, I'm sure that there is, like, somehow very similar to bee swarming or something. Yeah. I'm sure that there are very simple rules as to how far away from another bird they need to be, or how, if this bird does this, then I'm going to do this, and so that directs, like, the whole direction of the flock.
I have a question that just came to me right now. Are dolphins also
counting?
Pack animals?
I'm sure they're
counting.
Oh, yeah, they're pack animals.
They're okay.
Pack
animals.
I never even thought that.
Very
That's
social.
Right, pods of dolphins. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, extremely social. I would love to find actually more information on dolphins, like, running maneuvers out in the ocean.
Yeah, very, very, very little information on it.
Yeah.
Very hard to get primary research on dolphins, you know, outside of captivity.
Out in the middle of the ocean, I guess it's really difficult.
Just wanted to add to that the dog story, that there was, and we need to get these people on the show, although the brief thing I read yesterday said no mention of who or what department they were in, but here at UC Davis. It's follow-up work done on this recently. Very recently. I just read this yesterday. Work with dogs. Six different breeds of dog. Listening for different types of barking.
Yeah, that's in here.
Did I mention that there?
Yeah, and the woman's name... She's a veterinarian and animal behavior expert here at UC Davis. Her name is Sophia Yin.
Okay.
And we should give her a call.
We should. I'd love to hear what she has to say.
She's recorded the barks of 10 different dogs of 6 breeds and then used sound spectrograms to analyze the barks to determine, what situation was a particular bark used in. Does each breed have a different type of bark for each,
I think she was also saying, like, individual dogs will develop their own...
intonations and use of bark. Yeah, absolutely.
Especially, if they're isolated, you raise it away from other dogs.
This is only a very, very short blurb here, but I think it would be really interesting to talk to her.
Yeah, okay, sweet. Yeah, dogs are...
We'll email her today.
Dogs are smarter than you think.
I'm writing down a note right now to myself so that we don't forget to get her
Chris
on the show.
Chris has got a big black marker. She's writing it backwards on her forehead, so when she walks
by a mirror, I'll be like, yeah, okay, that's right. That's what I got to do.
No, it's on my forehead.
What's on my forehead?
I do think that dogs are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. I work with these guys, and they have three of these beautiful golden retrievers that are just...
I love golden retrievers.
Yeah, they start annoying you, and they come up to you with the ball or something like that, and they've got facial expressions with their eyebrows, and you don't really realize that dogs have eyebrows until they start doing the eyebrow thing to you.
Yeah.
It's totally creepy, and you're like, what do you want? And they're like, oh, ball. Okay. Cool. Weird.
You might like this one, a recent patent that's been that's being developed. Wearable computers.
Yes.
This is a...
When are we going to finally have those? They've been hyping those up forever.
Well, this is a patent that just recently...
Well, okay.
Was, like, this last week.
Well,
like,
I believe
went
you.
In. But I'm not sure if they've actually developed it yet or if they've just written the patent for it.
That's
convenient. That's the question, is whether or not we actually have these being developed now or whether or not somebody was like, I think I'm just going to patent this idea. This Smart Specs is the company of Roanoke, Virginia, have glasses with a small LCD projector embedded in the frame to display email or internet pages fed by wire or radio from a tiny computer that is stashed somewhere on your person. The image is projected onto the inside of the lenses, and then sound comes out of a piezoelectric speaker in the eyeglass frame.
Cool.
And then a camera is built into the nose piece and lets you take low-res snapshots of whatever you're looking at, and then while you're driving, the screen gets switched off, but the eyeglasses bounce infrared light off of your eyelids, and if your eyelids droop for longer than a second, then a loud alarm wakes you up.
Crazy.
So I think it's very, very
those
cool.
Those are like those Mission Impossible glasses.
Yeah.
Though I never understood how they fit a camera, or how it would even be possible to fit a camera in, like, that tiny wireframe glass. Anyhow.
Yeah. It has to be such... Well, they have, like, those little tiny cameras that are, you know, the... you know, they... For operations and stuff, where they go inside and they...
Yeah, but I don't know what the field of view or the focal length on something like that would actually be on the... you're talking about the fiber optic cameras and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I don't know. Should ask my dad since he works with that stuff.
I mean, if you're looking at something close up, it's going to be just a little tiny one.
Yeah, well,
but the further away you are from something, I'm sure the larger the view will be.
I guess.
Yeah, because it'll just be like a larger amount of...
The only time I ever seen those things used are like in brain surgery or when they're tunneling up through a vein or something like that.
But you're that's when they're like looking at something like right in front of the end of the camera, and so there's...
Yeah, so I mean,
yeah,
it's like
but
right
like,
in there and
yeah,
it's dark and...
What's in focus tubular. Is like the stuff that, you know, that comes within the focal length distance. And,
right.
Well,
and then right.
some of
the stuff
in
the
background.
I don't
know if that's what these are made. I mean...
I have no... Well...
I'm sure they'll figure it out before they...
Oh, I mean, it could be cool. You could have, like, the particular...
Now all we need is a small...
You could just have that be part of the camera. All you need is just the image to come in, and then a camera... You need a little lens, you know, that will take the light and send it to the computer, and so the computer will get the impulses, and then the computer can actually, you know, decipher what it is that you're
well,
seeing.
Even a regular camera, like point-and-shoot camera, doesn't have that big of a lens opening. It's just a little,
it's true.
Square.
But
I don't think they're going to be real cute glasses.
Not like mine.
Actually, I think they could look like
they
yours.
They probably would. Like
gigantic bridge and just wholly disgusting looking.
Hey.
Nice mirrored glasses,
don't make me give you a ticket.
In a super cop kind of...
That's
the,
right.
The question I have about this, or the interesting thing, will be to see how somebody is able to get a wearable computer put together. Because right now, like...
Right.
They've been talking about that for so long.
A little teeny tiny, tiny computer. I'm sure that they it's going to be like a Palm Pilot kind of thing. Or like a Strawberry. You know, one of those, or what are they?
Blackberry?
Blackberry.
Well, if it's just for checking your email and crap, yeah, I mean... Web TV.
Yeah, it's just going to be, you know, for surfing or whatever, for checking email.
Wireless modem. And
I think it would be absolutely easy. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would be little tiny and, like, super, super...
You just need a flimsy circuit board, you know, just press it out of some kind of flexible plastic and put in your
I
jacket.
Think the most interesting aspect of it's going to be just the small size of the screen and how they do that. I think that's what's most interesting to me.
Yeah, I've got a little segue here. Like a Japanese computer maker, NEC, developed the PowerMate all-in-one PC. So it's like something that's going to look kind of like an iMac or like an old-school iMac or...
That little cube thing?
Yeah, kind of like a cube. It's got a screen and then all the guts, and it's all kind of in this one housing thing that you kind of pick up and go, you know, instead of having a separate box for your monitor and a separate box for your computer. That's no big deal. And they're using the Transmeta Caruso chip, which came out actually quite a while ago, but it's those ones that are ultra, that don't have this huge power requirement and don't produce a lot of heat, but are able to compete sort of at like... Pentium levels.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about this is that they developed this, they've got their flat panel screen, right? And which doesn't contain lead like typical cathode ray tube monitors do. So that's one thing. And they also were able to develop a chassis, which is 100% recyclable for this whole computer mount. And they were able to develop, do all the connections on the motherboard and all of the different circuitry without the use of lead, so that this computer is less toxic than most computers being very toxic. You can't throw them away. You try to throw away your monitor, an old computer or something like that, and you go take it to the dump and they make you pay a fee and then put it in a special area to be recycled and to be, you know, to get all the lead out of it, because you put that in a landfill, it'll just leach into the soil.
Yeah.
A lot of countries,
and from there into the water.
Yeah, and a lot of countries are having problems with this because...
Big problems, because we shipped all our monitors to them.
Yeah, and we're just dumping
a lot of third world countries that we're just dumping our technology into.
Yeah, and
old technology.
And this technology is pretty hateful, but NEC's got this one, their PowerMate, which is a little bit more green. It uses less power. It's got its chassis, or the case will decompose or be recycled more readily, and there's less lead used in its construction than most computers. So,
yeah, good on them.
That's a good thing.
That's good. I think it's good that computer manufacturers start thinking about the fact that people are going through computers, that they're... You know, people who are into computers are go through them like crazy. Like, yeah. I think most of the computer geeks that I know have gone through something like at least 3 computers in the last year, you know.
I guess I don't qualify as a computer geek then.
No, I mean, like, you have like one monitor for a while, but then you got to change out your motherboard, and then you got to get a new graphics card, and then, oh, gee, a new sound card. Ooh, look,
yeah,
Sound Blaster. You
it's
know,
the whole Ulysses then, ship thing. You know, it's like you don't actually buy new computers, but it's like, yeah, you
all the
get
parts,
the parts
you take
are
out
changing
the old part,
so that,
the new
yeah,
part, yeah,
3 years later,
well, I
no
practice,
part is the
like,
same as it the, used to be.
Yeah, but when you practice, you know, proper trickle down parts, you know, allocation.
Oh, yeah, then, it's beautiful.
Then everybody wins because all this stuff hopefully gets recycled.
That's true. It's like hopefully, when you outgrow your clothes and your younger siblings get it. That's pretty much our computers running off of Greg's and Marshall's effluence.
Yeah, and then what gets tossed out of yours ends up in landfills. And
exactly.
Somebody somewhere has my monitor. That's all I know.
I think it's sitting at my house somewhere.
I want my monitor.
I think it's a very big paperweight at my place.
Yeah, it's probably pretty old at this point. So.
I mean, you don't want that thing.
I don't want that thing. I guess real quick before we go, last piece of news. An old antibiotic is being developed for use as a drug to treat Alzheimer's disease. There's a fringe theory that is gaining more and more ground with further and further research, and that is basically that Alzheimer's disease starts as a result of the buildup of metals such as copper, iron, and zinc in the brain, and then these metals turn beta amyloid, which is probably something that people have heard the name of in the news in the last year or so. Beta amyloid is an enzyme that, when it links up with these metals, that it then catalyzes the production of hydrogen peroxide, and the hydrogen peroxide goes on to create these plaques. You know, the interaction with the cells, because the peroxide kills the cells. And so this is a fringe theory, because most people think that it is actually these beta amyloid plaques that are the problem, and that not necessarily starting at the metal. So a lot of the current research and treatments is targeted directly at getting rid of or treating the beta amyloid plaques. And the difference with the use of this antibiotic is that it goes in and it basically binds up all the metals in the brain and takes out the metals that are being collected there. And once it takes the metals out, the beta amyloid no longer is in the form that produces hydrogen peroxide, so that the plaques decrease in size and actually stop being formed. And so it's a pretty cool thing. One researcher out of Ohio says that this sounds like a really good drug, but one that not only binds to the metal but then also acts like an antioxidant to mop up hydrogen peroxide could be even more effective in treating Alzheimer's disease. So we could definitely be seeing a decrease in an improvement in treatment in Alzheimer's with the coming years.
Cool. They just really quickly came up with a test that's been used to determine if sports players are all right after they just got a concussion.
Mm-hmm.
Someone just figured out that this same test is a great way to do early screening to see if people may develop Alzheimer's in a few years. And it's just a verbal test.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
It's good.
Are we all out of time here?
We're all out of time. That's it for this week in science. But stay tuned here at KDBS for more great programming coming your way.